know then that the word Masiyin refers now to making these fires. But we have a teaching which says, Ein Masiyin Masiyin Ela Chodesh Shenir Bizban Unakasha, that they would make these bonfires only when the new moon appeared at the time that it was expected to appear in order to sanctify it. Okay? Mihei Mosa Masiyin, and when do they light this? The answer is the Or Ibura. They did it at the eve when they expected to declare that it was an additional day to the month. Okay, so in other words, from this, the reference would seem to indicate what? That if they expected it on the 29th, on the 30th day, in other words, 29th day, but if the following day, they expect to make it to the center, so in that particular day, they would light it in order to inform that the president is declaring that to be the center. And it is, or the Ibura, the eve of the time when, you know, the following day is the perfect. So, the Maimra, this would mean then the Echzar of Dinun, and I'm going to look at that. We light these lights in order to inform the people only when the month is Chaser, in other words, only when the month has 29 days, right? But we do not do it when the month has 30 days. I'm all in love, you know, right? Say, am I Tama? For what reason? Some are Zera. But Zera said, Zera, Mishum HaShodesh, Chaser, Shecholi Yos, Be'er Shabbat. We want to make sure, he says, that we have Rishkodesh. If it is on Friday, and it's only the 20, you know, it's only following a month of 29 days, Rishkodesh. So, in order to do that, this is the reason why we light it early. Amos Avdei, how can we do something? It's about booking Rishkodesh. When should we light it? Light it from the toy shop, right? The Yamrit Navi, Nami Amali, also a Mita. Because if we are to say that we light these bonfires also for a month which is Mali, then in that case people won't know the difference they will make in the state. Like the one from the different thing, theoretically, I think we'll stop at this point because we have a new page coming up, but we know we will continue, as I said, 2 weeks from tonight. Sorry that I can't speak to you this tonight, but I have to be working on the problem. Tonight is the 31st of May in the year 2000. We are now on the top of Rosh Hashanah, Chav Gimel Amud Aleph, continuing to where we left off the last time. Okay. The problem that we are facing right now is if we light bonfires, we're talking about those, if they were to light bonfires only for a chaser, in other words, only when a month had 29 days, and they wanted people to know that it was Rosh Chodesh the following day, so that they would light it at night, and then the following day everybody knew it was Rosh Chodesh. So what are you going to do if you have a situation where it's going to be Friday? Obviously we're not allowed to light bonfires on Friday night, and so in that case, if we postpone it to Motzei Shabbos, you know, until Saturday night, then people will have the impression that the month first started at that time, not on the 29th, in other words, the day following a 29 day month, but the day following a 30 day month. They wouldn't know the they'll be confused. And Amre, therefore the verse says, what will people say? They say, hi, what's your who? So, says, well, okay, they'll say, all right, the month really should have had only 29. So I delay all this, yes, so why didn't they write the following days? They shouldn't delay extra, right? Because you couldn't, because it was Shabbos. But that's only one possibility that they're weighing. Or do a more. Or maybe the other possibility people say to themselves is that Molehu, since the month actually is Mole, in other words, it's a 30-day month, a preceding month, and therefore a Shaddish versus on the following day. It is Manulase, and they lit the candle, and they lit the bonfires on the night time, right? And therefore they're very confused because they don't know, is the previous month Chaser or is it Mole? Because they're not sure in this case, if it follows, you know, a Friday night. That night is Friday night, so what does Shabbos night, the bonfire mean? Does it mean that the previous day was, you know, was it Chaser or was it Mole? They don't know. So then, another suggestion, the other being a Mole, being a Chaser. So maybe we should light a bonfire to indicate that it's Rosh Chodesh, regardless of whether it is Mole, in other words, the previous month has 30 days, or a Chaser, the previous month has 29 days. Okay? So, in other words, let's light a bonfire, and whenever the bonfire is, that indicates it is Rosh Chodesh, and we would do it either following a 29 days or following 30 days. Sounds like a good way to inform people, right? But then Gemara says, "Vachim nikla Rosh Chodesh ker Shabbos, l'li yodik klal." All right. So, what happens if the Chodesh occurs on Friday? So, should we do nothing at all? The Gemara l'li yodin, since we're not doing anything, you know, not lighting any bonfire. So, Motzei Shabbos. So, in that case, everybody will say, yeah, the candle of Dinah Matzei Shabbos, if you say that you should only light it for a chaser, and therefore we should not light it on Saturday night, right? The Dinah Namole, and light the bonfire only after a mole, so maybe the chaser, right? So we would say then that people would know that the preceding day is chaser because of the fact that they didn't light bonfire. So Apilo Hoki says, it's very confusing, I have to say. So Apilo Hoki, so the Gemara says, even in this case, he says, also in this case, people are going to make mistakes, no matter which system you're going to use. Because Amre is going to say, hi, Mole Hu, right? The month pocket is Mole, the high is the odd day, and the reason why there's no bonfire at all is if you say who this is. Something occurred, an accident occurred, they ran out of fuel, or something prevented them from lighting the bonfire, right? And so therefore that's the reason why it is that we didn't get the ticket. So, when the Yevin are Mole, so let them do it, you know, for a month following the 30 days, and all the others are Mose Klal, and not to do it at all, if the month is lacking, in other words, that the month only has 29 days. So, other Rabbi says, Mishom Bitul Melacha La'am Shneyom. Says, I have a different reason why we shouldn't be doing it. Says, because of the fact that if people get the wrong signal, they'll never know, in other words, whether to celebrate Rosh Hashanah, for example, on the 30th day, that was the day following Mount of Elul, which presumed about 29 days, or whether to do it the following day, because maybe that year Tesla decided to make Elul 30 days instead of 29 days, and so therefore we're going to mean that they're going to have to observe 2 days to the other. Now, this is not just talking about a time when people still observed only 1 day Rosh Hashanah, there's Israel, and therefore Babylonia too, apparently, there was a custom to do it in those days also, only 1 day. They wouldn't know whether they would not be able to work for 2 days. At any rate, the system fell into disrepair, and the whole system, lighting bonfires, as you see, finally went by the wayside and said, how could they inform the community? So the answer is by sending. Yeah, by sending. Emissaries to the Bezdins, so they would be the ones to tell the community exactly when the Shodesh would be played on. Yeah, but along the same
line.
Yeah. But the problem, of course, it still would be, you know, in Babylonia. In Babylonia, they would still have to observe, therefore, 2 days in order to be sure, because if they've got to wait for the messengers to come, it would take a little bit longer.
Right.
In that telegraph.
Yeah, right. So that's what finally happened. However, since once upon a time they did use this, so therefore, we go now and continue to. Yeah, all right. We're on top, you know, all the dollars right now. Yeah, this one, I don't need more.
Okay.
Well, this is the following.
Oh, this is the following.
Remember that the whole description was that they would light it on one hill,
right,
at the Mount of Olives, and then somebody was standing at a hill, you know, some distance, he would pick it up, he would light it, and so on and so forth. But it's all the same time zone, more or less. So some of them undoubtedly would have to violate Shabbos if they're going to light the time zone. So therefore, there was no lighting coming up for Shabbos. Okay. Now, the Mishnah itself describes, if you remember, how did they signal? I mean, that they would take Hayu, Mati, Matsus, Yasin, Kutoyas, etc., etc. It says that they would take long poles of cedar wood, right, and they would soak it, and they would mix it together with the Ase Shemen, which I translated as the olive wood, but it may not be, maybe some other wood which has a lot of rosin in it, or something like that. Let's say a member like wine or something like that. They get it and tie it around, and then they light it, and then they would wave it back and forth. In, out, you know, out, in, up, down, and so on. So that was the signal, okay? Now, inasmuch as it says that they use poles of Eretz, cedar wood, right? So therefore, they now take a pasuk that we find in Isaiah, and they use that as a basis of a drash. Okay? And for here, I have to tell you, we try to understand what Rashi is saying, but at the same time, Askel also has an English translation, which I brought with me from the various streams, but I'll tell you, even they, I mean, they're stuck over there. So we'll do the best that we can. I'm no expert on trees. I'm the first one to do it. My wife is a much greater expert on it. Even so, when you start it, huh? Yeah, yeah. The this one over here. Who? Pliny. Yeah, but Pliny was he wrote books about nature. Correct. Okay. All right. So, at any rate, all around you today. Well, Yehuda said it hot. He says, you know, we think of the term Erez as meaning a cedar, right? This is what we say, right? The Erez Baboni Yiskel, for example, you know, like a cedar in Lebanon, he will grow tall, and so, you know, we say it's a mitzvah shel Shabbos, right? So, he says, as a matter of fact, he says, the word Erez is a more generic term, referring not only to cedar, but also to some other types of trees that are related to the cedar. Okay? This is what it says. So, there are four such types of trees. You have Erez, you have Patron, you have Achenes, and you have Rep. Okay? Alright, so first of all, Erez, I would say, still means a cedar. Okay? At least I hope it means that. What is Patron? Nobody knows exactly. Okay. H. Sherman, what we translated, as I translated before, as, you know, olive wood. Okay. because after all, normally the word shaman refers to olive oil, okay? As it does in the Bible, okay? And, but as we'll see, there may be another interpretation as well, all right? And then finally, the rosh. The rosh, they usually translate something like boxwood or something like that, okay? Citron, well, that would be the esro. Yeah. Eres Katron. Right, Katron. But I don't know whether that's different.
Well, I'll tell you, it's a good guess.
It's a good guess. Yeah, nobody knows exactly what it is.
Right.
Huh? Well, we didn't get to it yet.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So then he goes into a discussion. What is Katron? What is it?
There's another Rav.
The Rav says it's Adron. In other words, he says that this is the same as like the errors or something like that. In other words, he says that it's also a type of a speedifer. Okay. If that's what it means that. But the problem is, you know, that nobody knows exactly what it is, okay? All right. And the very Rabbi Shaila, the Rabbi Shaila school, they translated as, Amir, they said it's Madliga. So, okay, Madliga, fine. But since we don't talk the Arabic of where Rabbi Shaila was, exactly what does Madliga mean, I don't know. To take it simply as a proper name, okay? The Amrama, and there are those who say, no, it wasn't a Madliga, not that tree, but Gumish. No, it is the tree that they call Gumish, okay? So, okay, so it's either a Madliga or it's a Gumish, depending upon, but since, you know, we're not such great experts, it's
literally just saying the other tree.
Huh?
This is the elder tree.
The elder tree?
Edder.
Oh, E-D-E-R. Yeah, but so what is an edder tree? So what is an edder tree?
Same
thing
as another
tree. Yeah, so it's a gone spot. So what does it mean? So what tree is it?
After that, Rappers is that guy. You want to make a point of view the way of it.
Yeah. But the person's post.
Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. Okay. The point is, I mean, that is true. I mean, he quotes it from Beitzer, say that Rashi is okay. Half shame of you. Rashi said, yeah, that's the name of the tree. The name of the tree. And I mean, in the study of Beitzer, we say in Beitzer, right? You tell the hemp feather, he says, plant and feather.
Maybe today we don't even have those species.
Well, we may or may not. The trouble is, you know, that from a botanical point of view, what is the relationship between one and another? I don't know. Trees today, of course, usually they have both a Latin name, right? And then, of course, there's an English equivalent. But the problem is also the question of identification. I mean, do we know exactly whether this tree is this or this tree is that? Okay, so So he says, okay, some say Madliga and some say Gomes, right? Some say potato and some say potato, right?
Yeah.
Okay, the Madliga, the Rabba Bahuna, both of them are in disagreement with Rabba Bahuna, because he said, Amir Bei Rav, he says, you know, in the school of Rav, they gave the following interpretation. So they said not four different types are called errors, right? Four different types of errors, he says, but are stored in the errors. He says there are 10 in them, 10 different types. In Hermon, he puts the process in Yisrael. But in Yisrael, says, everything that is for, I will give literally in the desert. In other words, the Benisher, he says, he will cause flourish. In what was desert, he will cause the flourish trees, right? And he
gives a list of various things. One of them is Erez, which we translated as Shikah, which usually in the Bible they translate it in the Kashmir. Okay? That's the usual translation.
Huh? Here it says time. That shows you, you see the problem. Yeah. So, but you see the problem. The problem is that even though we know what the Hebrew name is, what is it in the English? That we're not sure about it. Okay? Alright. So, needless to say, Rashi also has some of his interpretations. We'll try to do whatever we can with Rashi. Some of it in French we can understand, but some of it is in old French that it's hard to understand what he's writing. Okay? Alright. So far we've identified two trees, right? Erez and Shikah. Then there's the Hadas. So Hadas we know, that's the birth. Okay? Because that we always talk about. For, you know, for circus, you know, we need Hadas, right? So that's birth. The eighth Shannon, right, is the origin, you know, it says, and the oil tree, right, or Simbal of God, right, and in the wilderness I will also cause to flourish the plant, right, the Rosh, which is translated as boxwood before, Tidhor, I don't know, I'm not sure myself what a Tidhor is, huh, teak. Was on teak, I thought teak only grew someplace like in Malaysia or something like that. You know. All right. Yeah. But the Ashur, it's another tree that I'm not sure exactly what tree that is. Okay. Large. Okay. Fine. Very good. Okay. Yaakov, all of them. Right. So, then the Gemara tries to give some definitions for them. It says, Erez, this is Arza. In other words, one in Babylonian they called Arza, in Hebrew they call Erez. Okay, so that's fine. At any rate, we'll keep the translation of cedar tree. Okay? Shita. What should we say about Shita? So they say that's Tunisa. Okay? Now, Rashi tries to give a translation for it. If you take a look, but Tunisa says, Tinya Belaz. But what is Tinya? I'm not 100% sure what exactly it is. It's not the pine, but it may be related to a pine tree. Okay? Huh? No, it doesn't sound like a fish. I agree with you. Okay? But the Gemara identifies it rather as, you know, some species of a pine tree, some species of an evergreen. Okay? If it's not a pine, then it's a fir or something like that. You understand? It's one of those things. Okay? Okay. Alright. Alright, then Hadas. So the Gemara says Hadas is what we call Asa. In other words, Hadas is the Hebrew name, and Asa, the word, is the Aramaic word for a mortal. Okay? Alright, so far, pretty good.
Yeah, that's possible.
You know, it has the same name.
Yeah, that's possible. You know, I'm not 100% sure. Eighth Shannon, which I was inclined to feel is more like some species of olive tree, but that's not the translation that now the Gemara gives. They give a different translation for it. They translate it as a farsimah, which would mean balsam. Okay? Not the Hebrew word for balsam, but okay, this is the way they translate it, okay, that this is a balsam tree. Of course, balsam also has, you know, a very nice liquid in it, and it's used, of course, you know, as a balm. I mean, the word balm, it actually came from the word balsam. Okay, Barosh, so that they say this is what in Aramaic we call Barta, okay. Now, Rashi says that that's a tree that we call Boso, but I never heard of a tree in French called a Boso. So I'm not sure exactly what it is, okay. Then, Tidhor, he says that's a tree that they call Shaga. So what's Shaga? So he says, take a look, It's called Shep Belaz. Now, what is Shep? I never heard of such a tree. You see, that's the problem. Because we don't know what, you know, the dialect that Rashi was talking 1,000 years ago, in the French, okay? So, that being the case, I don't know exactly what it is. Maybe I should read it not as Shep, but as Sap. Maybe it has something to do with, you know, a tree which gives sap, which is possible, okay? Hi. In other words, what we would call rosin. You understand? This is, I think, maybe what Rashi is trying to explain.
What trees do you have now? My recollection of Israel is it looks green.
Well, first of all, you have to realize that the we have more pages over here.
Oh, that's
yeah, right.
I gave them
already. You gave them already?
Yeah.
Fine. So okay, very good. All right, yeah. Sam, we have to realize a couple of things. First of all, Eretz Yisrael at one time had many more trees. But as time went on, not only people cut down trees for various uses, but particularly the various invading armies destroyed the trees. So this is one of the reasons why when the JNF was started, you know, they felt that one of the most important projects that they could do was right, is to plant trees. Exactly, right. To reforest Israel, right.
Reclaim the desert.
Exactly. So, Yeshayahu already had the same idea 3,000 years ago, you see, that the time had come, or at least 2,500 years ago, that the Rebbeinu Shel Olam is going to repopulate the desert and the wilderness, make it much more fertile, and one of the means would be to cause these various trees to grow once again. So, as far as trees are concerned, you find lots of pines in Eretz Yisrael, that you find. Yeah.
Yeah. The north, and they call
right.
it that little Switzerland. It's absolutely fabulous.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's surprising for a Mediterranean country, the flora and the fauna, they're very similar to New England.
Right,
the
right.
Hills,
yeah, up in the north, line. Right. In the north, and you see something along the same lines, it's true. There is a place in Eretz Yisrael called the Ot Kedomim, if I'm not mistaken, where you have all kinds of biblical trees. They purposely planted it so you can see what they look like. Yeah.
Yeah,
so,
Sarah, it's one of the first trees is Para, the Para tree.
Yeah.
And then also, when the Kohen and Sota,
yeah,
he takes hyssop.
Hyssop, right?
What is,
yeah.
I forget what the
azov.
Azov
is the Hebrew word.
That was
also right.
One of the first azov.
Right.
It's very interesting.
Yeah. So Okay.
You mean the red flame to germinate some of these old trees?
Yeah, yeah. Right. Then the next one is, Shaga. Yeah, but as I say, I would read Rashi over there simply as like the word sap in English. In other words, it would refer to some kind of a rosin tree, okay, which makes sense, right? Yeah.
But there would be,
right?
Like
also
trees have a lot of sap. Yeah. So
would need that tree to
last. Right. Okay, the next one over there that we find is Te'ashur. And they say Te'ashur, that means Shurivna. Okay, so that's fine, very good. So the question is again, how does Rashi translate that one? So, let's see. Now here he doesn't mention it. Okay. He gave no definition for that. Alright, so Zaino Larch, I mean. Well. Okay. Well, I guess Rashi lived in a suburb called Larch once. Okay. Alright. Now, alright, so far from the four types of arosim, it's grown to seven, mentioned in Yeshayahu, right?
Whereas, what was the statement made? The statement was made that there are 10 different types. So, if that's the case, if he only mentioned 7, then there have to be another 3 that we have to identify. Okay? That's what the Gemara says. Hani Shiva Havu. That's only 7. So, Kiyosa Rav Dimi, so when Rav Dimi came from Eretz Israel to Babylonia, so he gave the report. He says, Omar, he said, Hosif Alehem, they added to them the following trees, Alonim, Almonim, and Almogim. And what are Alonim? So he says, Alonim, he says, that's what you guys in Babylonia call Butmi. So Rashi says that this is Urmi, Umi. That would be like the elm tree. Okay? We translate it as an oak, right. Right, yeah. Right. Well, okay, it all depends, you know, right. Actually, Ulm is more like German. Ulm. Yeah, huh? Terebinth? Yeah, Terebinth. No, they're very similar. So I'm telling you, you see how difficult it is to identify these, okay? And then the next one, what are, Alonim, we said is Butmi. Almonim, what are they? So it says that's Bluti. So what Bluti? Huh?
Here it says Almonim are oaks. Alonim are elms.
Okay, fine. But here's Rashi again says that's Sikra, whatever that means. Belhas. Shegadalin, Bo, Pere, Shekorin, Glyonda. What exactly that is, I'm still not sure. Okay. But as you can see from the difficulty that I have over here, you know, in trying to identify them, that this is very, very difficult. Right. Okay. And, let's see, we still have another one over there. Yeah, we have Almogim. Now, what's Almogim? So he says that's Kasisa. But I have to tell you, Almog usually refers to what? To coral.
That's what he's saying.
Yeah. I mean, Almog normally means coral.
That's what he's saying.
So that, therefore, that brings another problem, which they're going to discuss right now. Namely, if Almogim are coral trees, I don't think anyone has ever seen a coral tree, but if you go, let's say you go to a lot and you take one of those boats that has a glass bottom, you see plenty of coral over there. So we have to come to the conclusion that the reason why they call it a tree is because it seems to grow like a tree under the water. Okay? So, since they've already mentioned that, okay, so now they bring a maysa about the Almogim. All right. Kisiso, says Rashi, if you take a look, says min eitz, it's a kind of a tree, ho'ola bekarka hayom. It rises from the bottom of the ocean, or the bottom of the sea, ushmo koralu. In other words, coral. Okay? So Rashi over there says that it's coral. Okay. Yeah. All right, so far, so good. So we've tried to identify these various places. Okay. But there are those who say, no, it's not those trees, but the three additional ones are instead Aronim, Armonim, and also Almogim. Okay, so that Almogim in both versions appears. But what are Aronim? So he says, Armonim, he says that's Eri. So, Eri. So, Rashi says, this is something called Laura. I think it means a laurel tree. Okay? Yeah. Shame, huh?
Bay tree. B-A-Y.
Bay tree. All right. As I say, Rashi identifies it more as a laurel. Okay? Shame, ho'ilon. There's Pirio Korean base. Okay, and what's the next tree? Armonim, right? So Armonim we normally translate as chestnuts, okay? But what do they call it in Aramaic? They called it Dolvi. So take a look at Rashi, and you see Dolvi says Castagna. Castagna is the old French for chestnut, Yeah. Yeah. Huh?
Plain.
He says plain, but Rashi says that it's chestnut. And as a matter of fact, in the story that we have in the Torah, you know, about Yaakov playing around with the trees in order to make the, you know, the sheep and the goats, you know, come out. So, you know, it mentions over there that they use it Armon. And there they translate it as chestnut. Okay? So you take your pick as to what it is. But you can see the difficulty that we have in trying to identify exactly what are these things. So, where I can understand Rashi is fine, but here and there, Rashi is beyond me, in all honesty. Okay. So, alright, in Yeshayahu, there's another pasuk, in as much as we mentioned Korel. So now they give another interpretation of the pasuk. Medrash, okay. It says over there, but see Adir lo yavin, which means that a mighty fleet or a mighty ship will not. Huh? No, I said Almogen. Yeah, well that was already said before. Right, Almogen, Kasisa, right. That was repeated in both versions, okay? Yeah, you're right. That's the Coral, all right.
So, say that again,
it's Coral. Yeah, right, okay. So in as much as they're talking about Coral, it says, see, Adir, right, the Leavre, no? That a mighty fleet or a mighty ship will not, today we use the word sea for fleet, but there, at sea, that refers to an individual ship, will not pass through it, meaning the river. What river? So the answer is, it's a miraculous river that will grow from Yerushalayim, from the Beis HaMikdosh, and spread its living waters everywhere. So Omar Rav, so Rav says, Zu Burni Gedola. Now Burni is a word, I think frankly it's related to the Latin word Birim. Birim means that you have two rows of oarsmen. You have trireme, you have bireme. Okay? Yeah. So in Latin it means two rows of oarsmen. In other words, this refers then to a mighty ship. If it has two rows of oarsmen, it has to be a big ship. Okay? So he says, Zum Burni Gedola. Okay? And then he says the following. He says, Hechi Yovdim. How did they get it? And we'll see what are they talking about. They're talking about Karol. So he says, "My sushis alfe gavri betresa yarche shata." Says they bring 6,000 men who work for 12 months of the year. The army law, or another version has it, that tresa alfe gavri, that there are 12,000 men who are working b'shita yarche shata, that were working, 6 months of the year. And what did these guys do? V'tani lo chola. They take this ship, this tremendous ship, and they fill it with sand. Ad shachta. So by the time, that period of time, all these guys are busy shoveling sand into it, finally, what does it do? It sinks, finally. Okay? Vinochis bar amorai. This has nothing to do with the Gemara teacher over here, but it means, and as Rashi says, bar amorai, he says, this is a guy who is a good swimmer. In other words, he's a diver. Okay? So they have this guy who's a good swimmer or a diver, take a favorite translation, and he goes, the Katar Atune Dechitna, and he ties, Katar in Aramaic is like Kesher in Hebrew, Kashar, okay? So he ties Atune Dechitna, ropes or strands of literally cotton, flax, but at any rate, whatever he's using, you know, some kind of a fiber that's very, very strong in order to make what we would call today cables. Okay? Bichasiso. And he attaches it to where? To the kasiso. What do we say the kasiso is? We said that's the Aramaic word for the albogen, right? For the coral. So he ties it to the coral. The Kotaluhub is Finta. And then he ties the other end to the ship. Okay? Alright, so far, what do we find? We find that the ship is just loaded with sand, right? And now it's tied to the coral tree. Okay? And the other end is tied to the ship. Okay. And what happens now? So, what happens is that the Naple Cholet. So now the guys, the workers, they come and they remove the sand that they put in. They shut it up, right, and they throw it outside the ship, right? The Chamed Mendalia Akra. And the more that they take out from it, the ship rises higher and higher, right? Masya, Machlif, and then finally, you know, it's up above, right? Machlif Al Chatrain Bekaspa. Okay, and the coral is so valuable that for one measure of coral, you get two measures of silver. In other words, it's very, very valuable stuff. Okay? Then he says, Thas Parvasa Havya. He says, there were three harbors, literally, where they practiced this. Three areas where they went fishing for coral. Okay? Tarte Be Armai. He says, two were in the Aramean, in other words, I think what he means maybe is like, you know, around Eretz Yisrael, someplace. All right. By the way, Parvasa, take a look at the Rashi over there, he says portal. In other words, we see the word port, harbor, right? Belaz. With the Shona Mishnah, it's called Namal. Okay.
Back up for 1 second. For
yes.
They sank the boat to create.
They sank the boat
to create coral.
To grab hold, he tied the cables to the coral tree. Okay? Then, as they took the sand out of the ship rose and it pulled the coral to the surface. Okay? Right. So that's the what we see over there. Okay? Right. Yeah. Right. So, two of them were somewhere in maybe off of Syria, might be when it says Armai, or maybe off Eretz Yisrael or something like that. And the Chada, and one of the harbors is the Ve Parsai. We find in the in Persian territory. Okay, the Ve Armai, that which we say is maybe in Aramean territory, in other words, maybe in Syria or something like that. So Maskon Kesisa, there they bring up coral. But the Ve Parsai, it's not coral that they're looking for, because maybe there's not coral over there. But Maskon Marganisa, instead, what do? They bring up pearls.
Bring up what?
Pearls. Umekaria says, and people call Parvasa, that particular harbor where this activity is going on, they call it the Parvasa de Mashmahig. You know, this is Persian. So it's the, and the Rashi says, Mashmahig, he says, this is the Namal Shel Melucha. In other words, the royal harbor, okay? It's a royal harbor where they get the pearls from. Okay. So it's a very nice Maisa. Okay, train of thought is simply this, right? We started with the word Erez, right? You see how
bonfires.
Okay, good. Started with the bonfire. The bonfire among the wood that they use for it, actually two of the things mentioned were used. One of them is Erez, right? And the other one is H7. Okay. All right. So now, since we're talking about the word Erez, and since you also mentioned the word Eitz Shemen, so I'm going to tell you that we have a tradition that there are four different types of trees that are subsumed in the, you know, under the word Erez. And then the next one comes along and says, well, I can give you 10, right?
Now they're coming.
And they quote the Pasuk of Yeshayahu, which Nebuch only mentions 7 different types. So therefore they're trying to figure out, and what are the other three? So they come, and in either version that we had at the end, they wind up that one of the things is coral. So since we're talking about coral, so I'll tell you a story of how did they get coral from by sinking the ship and pulling it up and so. Yeah. What are their thoughts?
Today it's a crime, I think, if you still
could be. but you know, just as in psychology they talk about, you know, by association, right? In other words, you get one idea leads to another in the process of, so the Gemara too, okay, so we have the same idea working, yeah. Okay. All right. And we have to wind up this with a very nice little medrash, okay? Omer Rabbi Yochanan. So Rabbi Yochanan says, "Kol shita v'shita shenotlu nochem Yerushalayim." He says, every acacia tree, or take your favorite, you want to call it a pine tree, whatever it is. But at any rate, every tree that the goyim took from Yerushalayim, you know, they destroyed the city and they took it away. He says, "Otsid Hakadosh Baruch Hu Nachzir in Lo." The Bnei Shalom is going to cause the trees to come back again to Eretz Yisrael, to Yerushalayim. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, Zion Midbar Hoyasad. Zion became a desert. Azin Lo Shenemar, and they quote again the pasuk of that we find before. The Yeshayo attained by Midbar Erez Shitar, right? That in the wilderness I will plant once more, cause to grow the Erez and the Shitar. And what do we mean by the word the Ein Midbar? What is Midbar? Midbar, he says, refers Ein Midbar El Yerushalayim. This refers to Yerushalayim. Shenemar, as the pasuk says. There, you know, Tzion Midbar HaYisrael, which means that Zion has become like a wilderness, and so therefore, by taking the two psukim together, attained by Midbar, Eretz Shittah, so we see that Zion, which has become as a wilderness as a result of the destruction wrought by the enemies of the people of Israel, who destroyed it, the Rebbeinu Shalom says, I will once more bring back all kinds of trees to Jerusalem. The Omer Rabbi Yochanan, and then Rabbi Yochanan came with another drash. It says, "Kol haloime Torah, whoever learns Torah, the Eino Malamda, and he doesn't teach it." In other words, not only should we learn, but we should also transmit Torah ideas to others. So he says, "Person who learns for himself but does not teach it to others, Dome lahadas b'midbar. He is like a very fragrant myrtle in the wilderness." And I recall quoting to you from English poetry, remember, "Full many a flower is born to blush in the sea and waste its fragrance on the desert air." In other words, it's a thing of beauty and it's there, but nevertheless nobody is even aware of the beauty or the fragrance that this flower has to offer. So this is if you keep it only to yourself and don't share it with others. Equally, but there are those who say, "Kol halome Torah umalamba," that whoever studies Torah and he teaches it also, "b'mokom she'ein talmid chachamim," where there are no other scholars, "dome lahadas b'midbar dechavim," says he's like a fragrant myrtle in a wilderness because it is precious. In other words, if you can come and transmit it to others, then in that particular case, even if there are no other scholars or anything like that, but your fragrance will be transmitted to others, the teachings that you have to do, and it's as wonderful an experience as being able to find vegetation in the midst of a wilderness where you never expected to find it. I like this. Okay. The other Rabbi Yochanan, since Rabbi Yochanan is quoted, he's quoted again. This time he's quoted with the following. It says, "Oy lohem," woe, says, to the idolaters. Why? "She'ein lohem takodah," because for what they did, there is no way for them to repay or to make up. What is it that they did? Well, because we have the following pasuk. Pasuk says, "Shenemar," written in the book of this thing, this is a quotation from Yeshayahu,
where it says Tachas HaNechoshes Obizor, in place of the copper I will bring gold. Tachas HaBarzel Obikesef, in place of iron I will bring silver. Tachas HaEitzim, and in place of wood Nechoshes, I will bring copper. Tachas HaAvonim, in place of stones, then I will bring Barzel, I will bring iron. In other words, what is he saying? He's saying that something can be replaced with something even more precious, right? This is what Yeshayahu is saying, that when Zion, for example, will be restored, in the context of it, right, then what was before considered precious is no longer, because it will be superseded by something even more beautiful, even more precious. Okay. But not finished yet. However, Tachas Rabbi Akiva v'chaveirot, to replace Rabbi Akiva and his fellow rabbis, his fellow scholars, Maim Aviyim, what can the Goyim bring in order to replace them? We have suffered a loss of such tremendous personalities, great teachers and everything else, because of the persecution of the Goyim. Remember, how did Rabbi Akiva and his companions die? They died as martyrs at the hands of the Romans for daring to teach Torah. So, who can replace them? What can the Goyim do in order to atone for this great sin which they have committed against our people? Balehem, who are there, right? And concerning them, we have a pasuk. The pasuk that we recite in the Alter Rachman, that we Shabbos, right? And we say, V'nikesi domom lo nikesi. But the Rebbeinu Shalom says that I will cleanse their blood which has not been cleansed before. In other words, the Rebbeinu Shalom will exact punishment from the Goyim because of the martyrdom. In the case of the book of Joel. Okay? And of course, the rest of the pasuk is by the Shem Shechem Tzir, that God will reign inside. Okay? So that the Rebbeinu Shalom will exact punishment on the Goyim for what for the atrocities that they committed and the loss of so many precious lives that they have suffered. For that, there is no takkah. Well, that's a good question. Does it mean that he's going to make the Goyim give restitution? It means that what they have done is an unpardonable sin. I think that's distressing.
How does the prophecy come through? And
The idea, as I said before, is that when Zion is restored, okay? This is what Yeshayahu is saying. He's talking about the rebuilding of Eretz Yisrael, Zion, okay? And he says that the future is going to be even more glorious than the Zion of the past, that in place of stones will be iron, in place of copper it will be gold, and so on and so forth. So it's going to be more beautiful, more glorious than it ever was. But there's nothing that we can do. In other words, replacements can exist, but can anybody ever replace the loss that we suffered with the death of our great scholars and martyrs and so on? This is the point he's making. Yes. Pardon me? Masuot are signals, fire signals. Okay? Yeah. We learned before how did they tie in the word Masuot. So they quote a pasuk in which they describe David saying that he burned the idols that were over there, okay? And the word that he uses over there is Vayatziyeh. So from this we see that the word has that particular context. That's how they interpret it. Yeah. When I was in Eretz Yisrael for the first time back in 1965, I spent a week in a moshav called Masuot Yitzchak. It was a Pearl HaMizrahi kibbutz, not a kibbutz, it was a moshav. And it's located not too far from Ashkelon.
that area is called the Darod. It's called the south. It's not the Negev. Negev is furthest. But this is the Darod, and it lies near Ashkelon. Mahtuot Yitzchak. But Mahtuot Yitzchak, the original one, was actually in the Gush Etzion. It was destroyed back in, 48 by the Arabs. And many people died, if you remember, in the Gush Etzion fighting and so on. Others were taken as prisoners by the Jordanian legion. And after a few years, when things settled down, so then they were released. But the land that was in Gush Etzion had been destroyed, so the Israeli government gave them a new area in order to build. And so the new one, they also kept the original name of Mahtuot Yitzchak. So, very interesting to live in a moshav, and to see a working moshav. This is what where people, the difference between a moshav and a kibbutz.
Yeah, yeah.
The kibbutz, everything technically is communally owned, whereas in a moshav, they work as a cooperative. Everybody has his own home, and whatever they earn, the sale of the products that they produce, is then shared among them, based upon their age and how many children they have and things like that. They take all these things into consideration. So it was an interesting experience. Oh yeah, of course.
Zion Midbar HaYisrael, which means that Zion has become like a wilderness, and so therefore by taking the two psukim together,
attained by Midbar, Eretz Shittah,
so we see that Zion, which has become as a wilderness
as a result of the destruction wrought by the enemies of the people of Israel,
who destroyed it, the Rebbeinu Shalom says, I will once more
bring back all kinds of trees to Jerusalem.
The Omer Rabbi Yochanan, and then Rabbi Yochanan came with another drash. He says, "Kol haloime Torah, whoever learns Torah, the Eino Malamda, and he doesn't teach it." In other words, not only should we learn, but we should also transmit Torah ideas to others. So he says, "A person who learns for himself but does not teach it to others, Dobe lahadas pamid, he is like a very fragrant myrtle in the wilderness." And I recall quoting to you from English poetry, remember?
Full many a flower is born to blush and seen and waste its fragrance on the desert air. In other words, it's a thing of beauty and it's there, but nevertheless, nobody is even aware of the beauty or the fragrance that this flower has to offer. So, this is if you keep it only to yourself and don't share it with others. Ikadi Amre, but there are those who say, Kol Alome Torah Umalamda, that whoever studies Torah and teaches it also, to Mokum Shein Talmid Chachamim, where there are no other scholars, Dome Lahadas Famid Bor Dachovi, says he's like a fragrant myrtle in a wilderness because it is precious. In other words, if you can come and transmit it to others, then in that particular case, even if there are no other scholars or anything like that, but your fragrance will be transmitted to others, the teachings that you have to do, and it's a wonderful experience of being able to find vegetation in the midst of the wilderness where you never expected to find it. I like it. Okay. The other Rabbi Yochanan, since Rabbi Yochanan is quoted, he's quoted again. This time it's quoted with the following.
Woe, he says, the Ode Kochovim to the idolaters. Why?
She'ein lahen takonim. Because for what they did, there is no way for them to repay or to make up. What is it that they did? Well, because we have the following post. Pasuk says, Shemar, written in the book of this Miskayans, it's a quotation from Yeshayahu, where it says, Pachas v'nechoshes obizorah. in place of the copper, I will bring gold. Sachas habarzel of the kesef. In place of iron, I will bring silver. Sachas ha'itim, and in place of wood, nechoshes, I will bring copper. Sachas wa'avonim, and in place of stone, then I will bring barzel, I will bring iron. In other words, what is he saying? He's saying that something can be replaced with something even more precious, right? This is what Yeshayahu is saying, that when Zion, for example, will be restored, in the context of it, right, then what was before considered precious is no longer, because it will be superseded by something even more beautiful, even more precious in turn. Okay. But we're not finished yet. However, Tachas Rabbi Akiva v'chadeva, to replace Rabbi Akiva and his fellow rabbis, his fellow scholars, Maimavim, what can the Goyim bring in order to replace them? We have suffered a loss of such tremendous personalities, great teachers and everything else, because of the persecution of the Goyim. Remember, how did Rabbi Akiva and his companions die? They died as martyrs at the hands of the Romans for daring to teach Torah. So, who can replace them? What can the Goyim do in order to atone for this great sin which they have committed against thy people? Balayam, who are there, right, and concerning them, we have a pasuk, the pasuk that we recite in the Upper Rachman of the Shabbos, right, when we say, v'nikesi domom lo nikesi. But the Rebbeinu Shalom says that I will cleanse their blood which has not been cleansed before. In other words, the Rebbeinu Shalom will exact punishment from the Goyim because of the martyrdom that they, in the case of the comes from the book of Joel. Okay? And of course the rest of the pasuk is by the Shem Shechem Tzion, but God will reign in Zion. Okay? So that the Ben Yishalelem will exact punishment from the Goyim for what the atrocities that they committed and the loss of so many precious lives that we have suffered. For that there is no takkan. Well, that's a good question. Does it mean that he's going to make the Goyim do restitution? It means that what they have done is an unpardonable sin. I think that's the question.
No.
The idea, as I said before, is that when Zion is restored, okay? This is what Yeshayahu is saying. He's talking about the rebuilding of Eretz Israel, Zion, okay? And he says that the Zion of the future is going to be even more glorious than the Zion of the past, that in place of stones will be iron, in place of and on the place of copper it will be gold, and so on and so forth. So it's going to be more beautiful, more glorious than it ever was. But there's nothing that we can do. In other words, replacements can exist, but can anybody ever replace the loss that we suffered with the death of our great scholars and prophets? This is the pardon me? Masuot are signals, fire signals. Okay? Yeah. We learned before how did they tie in the word Masuot. So they quote a pasuk in which they describe David saying that he burned the idols that were over there, okay? And the word that he uses over there is Vayatziyeh. So from this we see that the word has that particular context. That's how they interpret it. Yeah. When I was in Eretz Israel for the first time back in 1965, I spent a week in a moshav called Masuot Yitzchak. It was a poor little Mizrahi kibbutz, not a kibbutz, it was a moshav. A moshav. And it's located not too far from Ashkelon. That area is called the Daron, it's called the south. It's not the Negev, Negev is further south. But this is the Daron,
and it lies near Ashkelon.
Masawat Yitzchak.
But Masawat Yitzchak, the original one, was actually in the Gush Etzion.
It was destroyed back in,
in 48
by the Arabs. And many people died, if you
remember, in the Gush Etzion, fighting and so on.
Others were taken as prisoners by the Jordanian Legion.
And after a few years, when the things settled down, so then they were released. But the land that was in Gush Etzion had been destroyed, so the Israeli government gave them a new area in order to build. And so the new one, they also kept the original name of Masawat Yitzchak. So, very interesting to live in a moshav, and to see a working moshav. But the people, you know the difference between a moshav and a kibbutz. The kibbutz, everything technically is communally owned. Whereas in a moshav, they work as a cooperative. Everybody has his own home, and whatever they earn, the sale of the products that they produce, is then shared among the members, based upon age, how many children they have, and things like that. They take all these things into consideration. So, it was an interesting experience. Some kibbutzim
did very well too, but it doesn't mean that every kibbutz has done well.
No, it doesn't mean that every moshav is in the Buddhist movement. Okay. All right, we're now down on the last line over there, okay? And it says, in which place was it that they burnt these fires, the sacred fires? And then the Mishnah gave a series of names, exactly where it started from and where it ended. Let's go back to the Mishnah for a few moments. Yeah, right.
Okay, take a look at the Mishnah on the opposite page. Do you have it?
Okay. It's on Chaf Beis Omid Beis. Those of you who have the papers, I have to give out the... All right.
Chaf Beis Omid Beis. The bottom is the Mishnah.
I'll recite it orally, so you know what I'm talking about, all right? First, the Mishnah over there described, about this is about what the fires were like, and, why did they cease? But then they get back again, and it says, from where did they start? From where is it that they burnt these signals? So they started, first of all, the Har HaMishra, literally from the Mount of Olive Oil, which of course we call Har HaZeitim today, it's the Mount of Olives. By the way, Har HaZeitim, we also find in the Bible itself. Okay, the word is there, okay? But Har HaMishra is another name for it, okay? And then from there, and then it says, okay, the Sartava, apparently there's a mountain, let's say, towards the northeast of Yerushalayim, which is Mount Sartava, okay? And the Sartava, from there, the Lutina,
another place, Agrippina or something like that, right? And Agrippina Mechavron, right, to Chavron. Chavron already would be probably in the Golan Heights. It's no longer in Eretz Israel, okay? Mechavron, the Beit Falsin. And from Chavron, these signals were seen as far as Beit Falsin. The question is only where is Beit Falsin? So the answer is Beit Falsin is probably a mountain already located at the border of Babel. Okay? Or in Beit Falsin, and from there, so Lazoz and Mishon, they didn't budge from there. Ela Molech and Levi, Amale Molech. But instead, what he do, he, Molech, he signals out, maybe he brings back. Male, he raises it, more he lowers it, and so in other words, he makes a signal in all directions. Until he saw that the entire Golah was like one great big bonfire. Right. Of course, I mean, we understand that. But now, we're going to ask, first of all, my big built-in. What do we mean by Beit Yildin or Baltin, whichever it was? There are no dots on here, so you have to use your own imagination as to what the dots should be. Yes. We're coming to it, that's the next page. Okay. So Omar Rav, who of course lived in Babylonia, tried to identify this name that we find in the Mishnah. And he says, that's the next page that we have now, Zu Birah, right? He says, this is the town that we call, or this is the mountain that we call, Birah. Okay? So that's definition number one. Definition number two, my Golah. What do we mean by Golah? I mean, we know, we talk about Golah. Golah is the entire diaspora. But can we mean that the entire diaspora saw the signals? I mean, would it be seen by the Jews living in Greece, by the Jews living in Rome? Obviously not. So, therefore, what do we mean by Golah? So, Rabbi Yosef says, Zu Pumbedisa. This is the town of Pumbedisa, one of the big areas of Jewish settlement in Babylonia. Okay, this is Pumbedisa, the place where Shmuel had his Yeshua, and afterwards Rav also had to move from Nahagara over there because the Persian government destroyed Nahagara. Okay. So, and my Kibidurach Seish, the other thing, what do we mean that it looked like one great big bonfire? So Tana, so we have a tradition that says, Kol echod v'yechod notel avrukim v'yodah. Everybody took a torch in his hand, the yodah the Rosh Gadol, and he would climb up to the roof of his house, right? And obviously they would all start in, to wave it so that they looked, imagine if you saw at every single house people were burning torches over there, it looked like one tremendous great big bonfire cutting the entire area. Tanya, we have a following tradition, says Rabbi Shimon and Alonzo Himer. He says, Ah Kharim Michayar Igader Michavasehan. He says, we mention certain things, certain places in the Mishnah, but there are also other way stations in between where they also station people who would be on the watch and in turn, raise the signal. And these are the following communities, Kharim, Khayar and Gader. And, their immediate area over there. So, of course, the only the question is, number one, why wasn't it mentioned in the Mishnah? So he says, first of all, Iko de Amri, there are those who say, Beni Uveni have a Kayim, that these were in between, that they were not the principal places, where the signals were given. That's why they were not mentioned in the Mishnah. Okay. Omarov, Ikad Yamir, and there are those who say, concerning these last ones, he says, the Hach, Yisrael, Eretz Israel, Havu, Taimei, right? they were standing on this side of Eretz Israel, that is, they existed these places in Eretz Israel itself, the Malchosh of the Haggis, the Malchosh of the Haggis. And there are those who think that these places were on the other side, or maybe some on one side and some on the other side. Okay? So Omer Rabbi Yochanan, so around comes Rabbi Yochanan, and he says, you know what, I have the following tradition. He says, then call Achas V'Achas Shmone Pasos, he says, between each and every relay station, so to speak, right, it was a distance of 8 parasangs. A parasang was a Persian measure of distance. First time I came across it was when I studied Greek back in ancient days. One of the classics that they used to study back in the old days in Greek was Xenophon's Anabasis. I don't know if you've ever heard of it or what. Xenophon's Anabasis consists of a history of Greek mercenaries who were hired by King Cyrus, okay, to serve in his army, and then Cyrus was assassinated. And after his assassination, these Greeks decided that the best thing would be to get back again, to go back to Greece. So it relates the story of how they had to fight their way and how they traveled from this and that until they finally reached the shore of the sea, and when they were sighted, they said, Alata Talat, or Talata Talat, depending upon whether you're using the Athenian or the non Athenian pronunciation. Okay? It means that CSC, the same thing as the expression. But at any rate, it means sea in Greek. From there we marched on many parasangs, to the next town. And then we got so many more parasangs to this and so forth. So that's my first experience with parasangs. So what's parasang by the Greeks is parsa in the language of the time, okay? So the question is, of course, how much is a parsa? Obviously, it's much longer than a mile, okay? By the way, how do we derive the word mile? In Latin, it's called mille passus, which means literally 1,000 footsteps, because in other words, 1,000 paces. The Roman soldier, theoretically, was able to measure the distance that he walked in terms of when he walked 1,000 paces, that was a mile, okay? Now, it's not exactly the same as 5,280 feet that we have over here. So it's a little bit less, okay? And the tradition is that a parsa was 4 of these miles, okay? So that being the case, the parsa is somewhere over, between 3 and 4 miles, okay? All right, so you have it so far. All right. So he says, in other words, that one relay station to the next would be how many? 8, right? 8 parsons. So in other words, it would be roughly about, 24, 25 miles separated each one. Okay? Problem is, that none of these measurements are exact. Like, to this day, everybody is still arguing. We use the term amma as a measure of distance, right? The English are translated as a cubit, whatever that is, okay? So, the point is, with the amma, how much is an amma? It's supposed to be from here to here. But, if you have long arms, it's a little bit different than if you have short arms, okay? So, that being the case, they'll tell you 18 inches, 24 inches, and so on. All right, obviously, in the time of the Talmud, they knew they had a definite measure as to what it would be. Okay? Yes. That sounds to me just a little bit too short. Yeah, sounds too short. I didn't measure it. How much is a ravine that they have to have a wide?
So they try these days to figure in terms of how many grams, how many ounces, how many grams, and things like that. Okay, anyway, so we have a relative idea of, you know, the distance between them, and you can figure out how, you know, on the basis of sight, they were able to spread the message as fast as they possibly could to get even to the Jews of Babylonia. Omer Rabbi Yochanan, yeah, I said that already, yeah. So now it says, Kama Havalahu, so how much was the total of the distance? He says, Colossian the Tartin, in other words, meaning 32 parcels between one place, that is, you know, between the near place and the further place. In other words, let's say from Har HaMishcha, from the Mount of Olives, up to Babylonia. So they immediately raise the following question and say, hey, today if you try to make the journey, it's a lot more than simply 32 parasites, right? 32 parasites. Much more than that. So how do you say, how could you have somebody who comes with a tradition that there was 32 for the total distance? So, okay, you ask the question, so I got to give an answer, he says. Omer Abaye, so Abaye says, and Chol, he says, Istatume istatutim luhud rachet. Says, you know what happened? What happened is that the original roads that they had been closed up. Ditzim, as we have a pasuk, this is a pasuk that comes from Hosea, where it says, Lachain hinani sachis dalkech basirim. That, behold, I'm going to hedge in your road with thorn, so that you'll no longer be able to go through them, right? So in other words, the original roads, the shortcuts, they were closed up, so they were no longer available. Okay? And there's another pasuk also which is quoted this time, it's by Rav Nachman by Yitzchak from Abba Hoche. He says it comes from this particular verse. We have a reference to it. The service is written in the book of Eicha, you know, in the book of Lamentations, written Sivosai Ivo, that the Rebbeinu Shel Olam, or maybe it means the enemy, in this case probably means the enemy, that he has perverted, literally, my path. In other words, he's twisted them around so that they're no longer serving. Of course, if we wanted to put it in our own contemporary terms, we use the expression that, for example, we say, as the crow flies. What I mean is the crow flies. It means that if you make a direct line on the map, it's okay. But how many of us do we go from one place to another? Can we make direct lines? We know you have to go this way, that way, so forth. So that would be a similar idea. Now, they continue the description of what happens when the witnesses arrive in Jerusalem. And it says, Chotzer Gedolo HaYesod Yerushalayim. Yeah, back to the Mishnah, okay? By the way, it's an interesting Tosfos over here. It's the second Tosfos on the page. You see where it says Kama Havalahu plus in Tartan, where he says Tibor, he says. Tosfos says, I'm surprised, he says, why should this man should be Samitish Kayo when the temple was in existence? Nana, he says, Nechake Tuva. They had great distances even in those days between Babylonia and Eretz Yisrael. How do we know that? We know that because of the fact we learned something in Tainus. What did we learn in Tainus? We learned in reference to when do we start in to say the same Paula Bota Gavroha of Mehrabah, right? Okay. Now, we are living in the Golah, so we follow the Babylonian custom that they would start 60 days after Tukupas Tishrei, after the beginning of the fall season. Okay, that's when we start. But it works out, you know, with changes in the calendar and everything else, that sometime around December 4th, 5th, 6th, or something like that, they would start the same. But in Eretz Yisrael, they have a fixed date. In Eretz Yisrael, they always start, even as the Gemara says, on the seventh day of Cheshvan. Now, how do they get the idea of the seventh day of Cheshvan? That this is the official start of the season of the same Kalabatha. And there's the start of this very day, that's when they started. The answer is that they figured out how long it would take a person to go on foot from Yerushalayim to Babylonia if they were making the pilgrimage. There it is for the Sukkot, right? And then, of course, they had to stay food for the Atzeres. Wasn't allowed to leave before then, so after the Atzeres. The day following that, that's when they started back. And would take those who were the furthest away, it would take them 2 weeks to get back home in Babylonia. So, this is what Tosfos is quoting. It's quoting Tadisus. So, how do you account for it? But the answer is, again, we have to rely upon the statement that they had to take longer routes because already, even in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, the original distance between one and the other, you know, the short line that would have been in existence is no longer available. Okay, you know, it has to go through wilderness and everything else. You know, you're familiar with the territory over there. You know that when you go, if you wanted to go to Babylonia from Mount Israel, you cannot go directly. Because there's desert and other things like that. So you have to go to the north and then you go to the east, and so in order to be able to get there. And of course, days and years ago, when we were studying history, a subject that's hardly taught these days, right, Jerry? We used to speak about the Fertile Crescent. And that was the area of the Fertile Crescent. The Fertile Crescent. In other words, that was the area, you know, it went like from Israel around this way and so on into Babylonia, Syria, you know, and coming that area over there where the fruitful, right? If you were to go directly across, right after Jordan, right, you're hitting the Iraqi desert and things like that. So
you go up towards where Jordan is, up towards Syria.
Yeah, and you go actually into what is today Syria, right, and go around. Yeah, that's the only way. That's the way they went back and forth. Okay, so the Mishnah now speaks and says, Chotzer Gedor LaHoysov Yerushalayim. It says, in Jerusalem itself there was a great big courtyard, the Beis Yatzik Hoysoni Christ. It was called Beis Yatzik. Okay? Ulasham, and there, Kol Ho'edim is Kansim. All the witnesses, that is everybody who had come to testify that they had seen the new moon, they would gather together. Ubezdin Dotin Atzomsham. Okay? And the court questioned them over there to find out, you know, what kind of information they had to report and whether their information was reliable. All right? And they also made great banquets for them so that people should be encouraged in order to come. Okay? Boris Shona. At first, Lahoya Zozim Hisham Kol Hayom. Now, here we're talking about on Shabbos.
What do you have to do today? You have to give
a right. So, at any rate, if it was Shabbos, they're not allowed to budge from there, okay? And at first, they gave them no permission to budge from there, so they had to stay all day in this chotzer, okay? In this great big courtyard. All right, they gave them good food and everything else, and so on, but even so, they had to stay there. They couldn't budge from there. Naturally, why couldn't they budge from there? It was Shabbos, and they felt, you know, they did not want them to violate, you know, Shabbos by going further than the prescribed boundaries. Okay.
Of course, you're talking strictly about the witnesses.
Yes, yes, of course. So, since they created a hardship, so Hiskin Rabbi Gamliel, Zoken, so Rabbi Gamliel, the elder, he would be the grandson of Hillel, and he was the you know, the head of the Sanhedrin. Okay, so he made a takana, in other words, he made a ruling, Sheyuhume Halkin Alpai Mamel Cholurah, that they could walk 2,000 amos in any direction. Okay,
so guns fine. So in other words, they gave them, you know, the ability to get out of the chotzer, but not to go too far beyond. Of course, the question is, number one, what is an amok? Right. Secondly, did it mean that they could only go that far even though they were still within the confines of Yerushalayim? You understand? So, because that created a different problem. Okay. But at any rate, the Mishnah now deals with other things. Then we'll come back to it. Okay? All right. First of all, it says, for lo Abel Bilvat, not only these people were put, for not only for these people did Rabban Gamliel make special provisions, Elo Ab Chachoma Habon Yaleid, but also he made a provision for the midwife who has come, obviously she's come from beyond the Tukum, in order to help a woman give birth, right? They needed her for emergency services. Or people who were called in order to try to put out a fire or to rescue people from a fire, right? Latzil means to rescue people from a fire. They needed outside help, so they gave them permission to come in order to do it. Or if troops were besieging the city, they were given permission in order to go and prepare the people for this, right? Or if a river were threatening to overflow, or if you know, a building or a wall or something fell on top of a person, and they needed people in order to help get the survivors out. So he made the takona that hare elu kan sheha'ir. They are to be considered as if they were residents within the city, which means that they could go anywhere within the city and even 2,000 amos outside the city. As it says, and they have 2,000 amos in any direction that they had to go, obviously outside the city. So in other words, he made special provision for them, and he decided it was not a violation of Shabbos that the services were needed. But the important thing is, it's not only to come in, but he also gave the last group of people that we mentioned permission to go home. I mean, you realize that, for example, it's a problem. It's obvious. A doctor, for example, if he has to go to the hospital, you know, in order to, he certainly has to do it. He has to save a life or something like that, he can do it. Question is, then can he return home, or does he have to stay over there, you see, right? So, of course, the answer is, based on this takana, he can go home. Okay?
Yeah.
He can go home. And it depends how we're talking about. Are we talking about walking, or are we talking about riding? That already happened. To ride there is no question. That's permitted. In fact, I mean...
even on
Shabbos.
If a doctor...
If a doctor has to save a life, he's permitted to ride in order to do it. If you have, if your wife suddenly, you know, she has she's ready to give birth, right? It's a mitzvah for you to drive her to the hospital.
Yeah.
Well, what about Shalom? I mean, the kid gets very sick, he runs a tremendous fever, or he falls, and so on. Pikuach nefesh, I mean, so if the pikuach nefesh, you're permitted to do it. The question is, afterwards, what can you do? So, walking, even if it involved, let's say, a violation of walking more than the 2,000 amos outside, of course, if you're within Springfield, it's not a problem. But, you know, let's say if you're an area, you know, which, so they have the, right, and in that particular case, they have permission based on this to go back home.
How far is it?
Huh? How far is the amo?
Amo.
Okay, as I said, an amo is either a foot and a half, or it's 2 feet. Okay, let's say 2 feet. Multiply 4, 000, it by 2,000. All right, so it's 4,000 feet. So it's still less than a mile. Right.
Less than a mile.
Less than a mile. Right. Yeah. Okay. But, you know, we're talking about the violation of Tum Shabbos. Now, obviously, you know, within the city, the law has changed, as you realize. I mean, that the interpretation of the law. Okay? So that we consider, you know, the city itself as an area. Originally, a city had to be what? Surrounded by a wall. Then it had to be, have an area, which was like a fictitious wall, if you want to call it, you understand? But even in an unwalled place, as for example, let's say Springfield, but still you are permitted to walk outside the boundaries of Springfield because it's all contiguous territory. I mean, the houses, is there real mark, line of demarcation between Longmeadow and Springfield? Of course not. Or between Springfield and Chicopee again, for this, yeah. Right, it's inhabited, yeah. Whereas if you had just, you know, empty fields or something like that, that's already a different problem, right. Yeah, 2,000 would be the limit then, right. Okay, so now the Gemara has the following question. It says, the question was asked, Beis Yazik, okay, this name Beis Yazik, it says, Tanat, all Beis Yazik, Tanat. Did we learn Beis Yazik with an ayin? Take a look at the spelling, right? Yud, ayin, zayin, kuf, or is it simply Yud, zayin, kuf? In either case, how could we pronounce? We could call it Yazik, right? So what is the correct spelling of it? So you say, no, so we should call Mr. Webster to find out how to spell it. Or let's say, you know, some of the great lexicographers like Bialik and Krasovsky, or let's say Eliezer Ben Yehuda, and so, you know, these people who wrote lexicons of the Hebrew language. So the answer is, no, it's based upon psukim. And each pasuk, you know, has a certain connotation to it. So, it says as follows. Beis Yazik, that's the one with the ayin, Tanan. We, those of us who learned that, that is spelled with the ayin, it says, Lishtam Ayahu. It refers, it's a language which speaks about something very good. Dichsiv, as we have a pasuk, there's a very famous quotation from Yeshayahu, beginning of the fifth chapter over there, where he speaks about his vineyard. And he tells over there how he tended it, he took care of it, he did every kind of thing in order to make this into the most beautiful vineyard that he could possibly do, right? And then what happened? The vineyard got spoiled. The grapes were spoiled, okay? And of course, you know, that is what we would call the marshal, right? In other words, the example, the parable that he gives, and then what is the nimshal? What is he talking about in reality? The answer is talking about the people of Israel, how God loved the people of Israel. He tended them, he did everything he could to show his love for them, and yet, you know, they spoiled things, right? Okay. So, we're still in the first part where he describes all the good things that he did. So, Vayazkehu, Rashi, translate the word by Askel, he says that he made siyag la gader. In other words, he made a fence around it in order to make sure that it would not be trampled by the animals and so on, right? By saklehu means, and he removed the stones from it. In other words, to make it, you know, fertile. So then this would be, in other words, a sign that Yazik, coming from this root, means that it's a beautiful place. Oh, Dilmo, or perhaps, Beis Yazik Tanan. Maybe we should learn without the ayin. And in that case, it's Lishna Desarahu. It's a language which expresses pain, sorrow. Kidisiv, as we have a pasuk which says, we're talking over here about the prophet Jeremiah, who preached to the people of Yerushalayim that they should not go back on the peace treaty that they had made with the king of Babylonia, with Nebuchadnezzar, to remain loyal and not to rebel against him. But there was a war party in Yerushalayim at that time, that they said, we're going to make war, we're going to beat the Babylonians and make, you know, become free and so on. So they didn't like Yirmiyahu's preaching, so what did they do? So this is what they did. Namely, they put him into prison and tied him up with chains. They bound him with chains. This is what the word means over there. It's Kehu, that they bound him by Zikim, you know, with the chains. Okay. Who are Sorek? He was tied up by Zikim with chains. All right. So,
either it's good or it's bad. So Amar Abayi, so Abayi said, Toshba, hey, didn't we just learn Sevudos Gedolos Hayoisen Lahem, Shon? Kadeshura Gidim Lavo? Right? Didn't we learn that it says in the Mishnah, it says over here that they used to make beautiful banquets for them so that the people should come? So the Gemara says, yeah, and no. What is the yeah and the no? He says, Dilma says, maybe Tarta Habadimu. Maybe it has both significances for them. Namely, it was good. They were gathered together. They had a chance to see people, to spend the Shabbos together, to have a good meal, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, what was the sorrow, the pain that was involved? They couldn't leave the place. So the feeling that you can't leave a place is also not a good feeling. So therefore, maybe both are legitimate spellings for the place because it has both significances. Okay. We'll do one more Mishnah, I think we'll call it a night. Because here we're getting okay. Now, so Ketzad Bodkin is later. How did they question the witnesses? After all, they wanted to make sure what? That the witnesses were telling the truth, that they were reporting exactly what they had seen, and that there was no fake. Okay. So, Zug Shabar Rishon, Botkinosa Rishon. Okay, the first pair of witnesses who came were the first ones to be questioned. Machnisin is Hagolo Shabahan. So, they didn't question the two of them together. Instead, what did they do? They took each one separately. Okay. So they took, first of all, the one who is the older one among them, in other words, the one, you know, who is the more important person in the pair, and they would put him aside. The Yomim Lo, and they would say unto him, Emor, tell us, Kate Sadra Yisus Halabona, how did the moon look to you when you saw it? Was it Lifnei HaChama or Le'achar HaChama? Was it in front of the sun or behind the sun? Good question. Now we have to imagine right now what it was like. Okay, so you have to bear in mind moon. Okay. It's not a banana, this is the crescent moon, okay? Okay, so was the sun here and the moon there? In other words, the sun is in front, right, and the moon behind? Or was it the other way around, that the moon was here and the sun behind? Okay? Next question? Yeah? Bitzfona or the drummer?